Okay, Hugh's going to come up, but you know, I wanted to tell you a discovery that I found. It was biology, and there was a specific name now that they have for cows that have really, really short legs. It's called ground beef.
I didn't come with any jokes prepared for today. So
sorry. You could top that easily.
Through the airplane.
Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Good to be back. This is the
turn
longest.
Turn the mic on, please.
You turn the mic on?
Yeah.
How's that? Testing 3.14159.26. Thank
yeah.
you. Good. That will work.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is actually the longest time I've been away from home on a ministry trip since 1988. I typically make sort of limited no more than 10 days. That's only when I go overseas, but this was 16 days. And it was three states, North Carolina, Virginia, and then Tennessee. Virginia, I should tell you an airplane story first. Okay. On the airplane, going to Charlotte, and there was this lady, we have a middle-aged lady, and she was watching a movie. And I was preparing my messages, because I was scheduled to give 9 lectures at Regent University. So I was working on those, and she says, gee, can I ask you some questions about the slides you're working on? So found out that she was not a theist, but she was a deist, and just was really intrigued that I actually believed that God was personal. And says, are you one of those people who believe the Bible? And so it got into a really good conversation, and it ended up with her saying, I'm going to commit myself to read 2 of your books. Which 2 should I read first?
Wow.
So I asked her more questions. But my book, Always Be Ready, I make the point that when you meet some stranger and they're not a believer, you need to find out what kind of unbeliever they are. What are their issues? Because I think one of my criticisms of modern day evangelism, people basically give a generic track. One size fits all. And that really doesn't work. So just asking lots of questions to find out exactly what kind of unbeliever they are, what are their issues, what are their barriers, and then give them or recommend some resources that target that those specific points. So I was able to do that. And in Charlotte, North Carolina, that was where they had the world's largest apologetics conference. And this year they broke a record for attendance. About 3,000 people showed up.
Wow.
And they had 102 different messages by over 80 speakers. So I couldn't believe that they actually found a facility that could house all the venues and the speakers.
Was that at the Billy Graham Center?
No, it was at a mega church in Charlotte. And I couldn't believe all the classroom space they had. I mean, here at SMCC, we're struggling to get adequate classroom space. They had rooms that would seat 700, 900, 4,000, I mean, you know, 100, 200. I thought for sure they're going to get down to rooms that only hold 30 or 40. No, no, almost all the rooms held over 100 plus. So I got to speak twice at the event. And one of my messages, the room was packed out as a room that held 800 people, and people were standing. So, and I was encouraged because I was actually speaking at the same time that Josh McDowell was speaking. I figured, well, everybody's going to go hear him. I'll have 2 or 3 people. But it worked out well. And I basically spoke on the message I gave. Well, it was basically an expanded version of the reasons for a message I gave just before we left, which was held at our headquarters, where I spoke about how the latest scientific discoveries give us a much more powerful case for the complete inspiration and inerrancy of the message of Genesis 1, particularly the new research that expands on creation days 3 and 4. So I gave an expanded version of that. By the way, I'm going to be repeating that tomorrow. They want to record it. And basically it's a story where I tell you where Genesis 1 stood with respect to science in the 1950s, the 1960s, the 70s, the 80s, year 2000, and where we now stand as of 2 months ago relative to the published literature. Basically making the point, the more we learn about science and nature, the stronger case we get for the complete inerrancy of the Bible. So, and incidentally, that'll be tomorrow at 1:30 at our headquarters. If you can make it, we're hoping to get an audience because we want some Q&A. So you're welcome to come if you can make that.
Dr. Ross?
Yes?
Are you sure Josh McDowell wasn't in your audience?
No, he was speaking to a crowd of thousands, so. No, he had a great message. And I'd heard the message before, so I decided I'd better give mine and not go to his, so. But the conference ended with kind of a five-way moderated debate. This conference is sponsored by the Southern Evangelical Seminary, and so Richard Land, who's the president of the seminary, at the end of the event, and this is a plenary session where everybody attended, and Richard Land moderated a dialogue with me, Norm Geisler, Richard Howe, who's a seminary professor there at Southern Evangelical Seminary, and he's a young earth creationist. And then it was Dr. Gazulia from the Institute of Creation Research. They had originally invited Ken Ham to come, but he wound up dropping out, so they got the main speaker from the Institute of Creation Research to come. And the whole theme was, the age of the earth and the age of the universe a matter of biblical authority, or is it a matter of biblical interpretation? And so Richard Land first went to Richard Howe and said, well, you're a young earth creationist, and we all know that most young earth creationists see this as a watershed issue, that this is a matter of biblical authority. And you're really not a Bible-believing Christian unless you believe that the universe is less than 10,000 years old. And he said, no, it's a matter of interpretation. It's not a matter of authority. Moreover, he said, we've got to stop using this language of semi-creationist, compromiser, aberration. He says, that language needs to go. And so then they turned to Norm Geisler, and he said, what do you think the age of the universe is? And he says, well, I'm not really that much on science, but the science I know, to me it's convincing the universe is billions of years old. And there's no way anyone should try to, it's just overwhelming evidence. But he says, I think the earth is only thousands of years old. So that was a bit of shock. And he says, 3 days of the week I'm young earth, 4 days of the week I'm young earth, 3 days I'm older. So I'm ambivalent on that situation. And Dr. Gazulia from Institute of Creation Research said, no, everything's less than 10,000 years old. And he made a big deal about the genealogies. And he basically stuck to a message. He says, the plain reading of the text is what we should always go for. And he kept insisting the plain reading of Genesis 1 is that these days are 24 hours. I was at the end of the line, so they said, what do you think the age of the universe is? And I says, 13.79 plus or minus 0.05, so billion years old. They said, what about the Earth? I said, 4.5662 billion. And so that's plus or minus 0.0001. So I said, do you really think the scientists have it pinned down that accurately? I said, they really do. And, there are many books written by both Christians and non-Christians that establish why those dates are secure, but also made the point that we had reasons to believe hold that we, the humans, are relatively recent on the scene. We're not talking thousands of years, but tens of thousands of years, maybe even as much as 100, and that we're all the result of descent from one man and one woman that God specially created. And that seemed to be important because the gentleman from the Institute of Creation Research was trying to say, hey, if you believe in billions of years, you basically believe that we humans are the product of natural descent from common ancestors with the apes. And I says, well, I do know some people believe that the universe is that billions of years will hold that, but that's not true of everyone who believes that it's that old. But most of the conversation focused on, you know, non-Christians watch us, and they watch the language and the demeanor with which we engage one another. And therefore, regardless of how old we think the earth is or the universe is, we need to change our language and our demeanor and you know, stop vilifying people who disagree with us on this issue. And since everyone agreed it wasn't a salvation issue, and we need to get rid of such language as you know, compromise, semi-creationism, etc. And interestingly, everybody agreed with that. They got a rounding applause from the people that were in the audience, and a really good Q&A. But I was seated beside Dr. Guzuya, and so afterwards I talked to him and said, you know, this would be a tremendous breakthrough if you at the Institute of Creation Research would actually take a different stand than, say, Answers in Genesis or Creation Ministries International, and actually remove from your website terms like semi-creationist and compromiser, or calling into question that, you know, someone's theology is aberrant if they don't agree that it's just thousands of years. And he said, well, I don't think I could ever convince my colleagues of that. And I said, well, you just made a statement in front of these 3,000 people that that's the way we should go. Would you at least be willing to encourage your colleagues to go in that direction? And he said, I don't think I can do that. And I said, well, what about you personally? How about if you personally were to basically commit to avoid using that language? And he said, well, I can't really say that either. So it's like, however, I shared with Dr. Richard Land afterwards and Richard Howe and said, because you know, Richard Land is old earth and Richard Howe is young earth. I said, this is the first time I think there's ever been a public event where this issue is actually raised. You know, can we at least lower the level of the vilifying rhetoric? I said, I wasn't surprised that you know, Dr. Galuzzi behaved the way he did. He's under a lot of pressure. But I said, you know, if we were to do these meetings more often, eventually, I think the public pressure in the Christian community would be sufficiently great that it will change the level of the demeanor and the language that's being used. Because they were kind of discouraged. They thought they could do it all in one meeting. Says, no, this has been going on for, you know, 5 or 6 decades. It's going to take more than one big public meeting like this. In fact, I think it's going to take 10 or 12 meetings like this before we see a change. However, this is the first time any kind of meeting like this has happened. And so I'm encouraged, because I think, you know, if we can do more of these kinds of events in many different parts of the country, eventually it will change the level of dialogue. And that's going to have a big impact on impressing non-Christians. Hey, these Christians really do like one another. You know, they'll know you're my disciples because of your love for one another. I think we really need to make that kind of a clarion call on all these issues where Christians divide. And this isn't the only issue, of course, over, you know, which we divide.
You know, Hugh, just like my namesake said, this could be the start of something big.
It could be. Well, I think it was. I mean, the fact that 3,000 people were there, and what I really noticed was, I was concerned because there was a large young earth contingent there that they would not be in favor of removing that kind of language, but everybody was clapping and cheering. So I think things are different now in 2018 than they were, say, back in 1980 and 1990. I think there's a growing recognition, even within the young earth community, we need to change our language and our demeanor over these issues over which we divide, particularly if they're not salvation issues. And that's one thing I pointed out too. Notice the age of the earth is not in any of the creeds of the church. So, yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but this almost seems too young to be a salvation issue, in that Romans 5:12 death came by sin, sin by one man. And thus, if we have death before sin, the big ripping teeth of dinosaurs, then we're denigrating how death came, and that denigrates Christ's shed blood on the cross. Do I ever hear that people addressing that doctrinal argument, that people who are young earth seem to be noble, if you will, in their own viewpoint, to defend Christ's death on the cross in the very center of Christianity?
Well, I actually talked to Dr. Guzzi about that, because I said, you know, it's on your website that I hold aberrant views, because they conflate the doctrine of the atonement with the age of the earth by that very message, you know, like. I said, you know, how about taking that off your website? And then again, I've got no commitment. But I think that's right. They say it's not a salvation issue, but the point is that they also make a follow-up comment that if you hold to an older view, that damages the gospel message, which basically is saying the same thing. It really does make it a salvation issue. And many years ago, I was in a closed-door meeting. It was 30 leaders of young earth organizations and about 15 of us that were leaders of old earth organizations. And it was moderated by a theologian who said, you know, we Christians differ on many issues, but the point is, how important is the difference? You know, we're talking about the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. He says, I define that as a level one issue. Level one meaning, if you don't believe it, then you're really not a follower of Jesus Christ. But he says, then you've got a level two issue where, hey, if you disagree with me, then there's really no room for you in our denomination, because this is the way we do things. And then a level three is where it makes no difference whatsoever, and has no bearing on who we fellowship with or, you know, what class we get involved in. And so he asked each one of us to put on a piece of paper, private, closed ballot kind of thing, where we stood with relative to the age of the earth and the universe. Was it level one, level two, or level three? All of the old earth creationist leaders said it's either level three or level four. So I didn't even define level four. I was saying, well, we're just saying this really should have no bearing whatsoever in any context. Every one of the young earth creationist leaders put it at level 1.2 or 1.5. They didn't say it was a level one, but they did say, you know, it's so important that it does serious damage to people's understanding of the gospel if they hold to an old earth view. And for the very reason that Steve pointed out, they think it's got something to do with the atonement. That if you actually believe that the earth is billions of years old, then that means you've got death before Adam. You've got animals that are dying, and you've got bloodshed, and the Bible tells us that the shedding of blood is for the atonement of sin. Of course, if you read Hebrews carefully, it says that the blood of goats and cows has no benefit for the atonement of sin. It's simply a symbol for the blood that does save us. And so the shedding of blood of animals has no bearing whatsoever on the doctrine of atonement. But I think there's also a sentimental issue that an all-powerful, all-loving God would not have animals dying unless he could blame it on human sin. But that has a doctrinal problem too. Adam was not the first sinner. Eve wasn't the first sinner. Satan was the first sinner. And we have no idea when Satan sinned, except he obviously sinned before he entered the garden. And I've actually met young earth creationist leaders who claimed that Satan fell just a few seconds before he entered the Garden of Eden. Well, they're right, the Bible doesn't give us an explicit date, but I think that's a bit of a stretch to say that, because it seems like he had a pretty well laid out plan on how to deceive Adam and Eve, and I find it difficult that that would be conceived of in just a few seconds as he's walking into the garden. So, for one thing, you'd be wondering, why is God letting me in this garden? So, yes, so now I'm going to get to you. Got your
answer. I was wondering if they believe that Jesus died for pigs and goats and horses.
Well, I've heard them say they believe that Jesus died for all, and they mean the entirety of creation. So, yeah, that sometimes is an issue. So, But I think what's more important is this idea that death is so horrible, so bad, there's no way we could ever link that to the love of God. And yet you have God sending his own son to die as an expression of love. And all throughout the New Testament, it tells us the only way we as humans can live is to die. We have to die to self in order to live eternally. So I would argue that death is not a bad thing, it's a good thing. And if you notice in Genesis chapter 3, the moment that Adam and Eve rebel against God, what does he do? He blesses them with physical death, because they had the potential to live forever physically. But God said, we have to block access to the tree of life, because if they get to the tree of life, they will live forever physically, but they'll be dead forever spiritually. And so God blesses us with physical death to redeem us from the far worse consequence, whence the spiritual death. So when we die physically, we continue living. I'm going to answer your question first, and I'll get back to you. Go ahead.
You know, there's quite a few atheists in this group I belong to where I try to witness to them, man. And some of them aren't scientifically minded, and some of them are one of these, right? But they love to mock younger creationism, you know? And so it's kind of refreshing. I've had some of these atheists actually say it's refreshing to know that there's this different interpretation that has something to it. It's not just some kind of ad lib or something, you know? Mm-hmm. And then a second thing, back in 2000, I remember my wife and I visited a Baptist church in Monrovia, which I won't name.
Yeah, it was only five or six of them.
And they said, the preacher was saying, Dr. Hugh Ross is a heretic. He's an evolutionist. He believes in theistic evolution. And that just made my skin crawl. Not only that they were calling you names, second of all, you're not a heretic. And third of all, you don't advocate theistic evolution. And so if we can dispel a lot of these false rumors that I don't know if they're still going around.
Well, they're still going around, and it's understandable in this sense, because the young Earth model requires very aggressive biological evolution to work. And a lot of young Earth creationists aren't aware of this. But for example, they believe that there is no death of plants and animals before Adam sinned. And so they posit that when Adam sinned, several of the herbivores rapidly evolved to become carnivores, including sharks. And so you've got this creature who is just eating vegetables in the sea, and now it's got a liver that's one-third of its body size and can only survive on meat and fat. And then with the flood account, they have only thousands of species of life on board the ark, and after the flood, those thousands evolve rapidly into millions. And as many atheist evolution or biologists have pointed out, this is evolution at a rate that's more than 10,000 times as efficient as what any of us have ever even dreamed to speculate. Now, because they believe evolution is that extremely efficient, once you concede billions of years, they say it's all over. Because if you just take that rate of evolution that they have in their model and extrapolate it over millions and billions of years, then you don't need to have God involved at all. So that's where they get this idea. If you believe that life has been here for a couple of billion years, you must be an evolutionist, because of the fact that they believe evolution is that extremely efficient. But one thing I wanted to share with you, the really the heart of the dialogue between me and Dr. Guzlia, was the plain reading of the text. Because he kept repeating that mantra over and over again in this hour-long dialogue we had, that the Bible is meant to be read in the plain way. And his background, he's an engineer and a physician. And he says, when I write a prescription, I say, take two pills by mouth. I don't expect people to speculate, is this the mouth of a glacier? Is this the mouth of a river? He says, the plain reading of the text. And so he kept insisting the plain reading of Genesis 1 is that these days must be six consecutive 24 hours. But I disputed that and said, I didn't know any Christians when I was reading Genesis, and the plain reading of the text told me these are six consecutive long periods of time. And Norm Geisler came to my defense and says, yes, when you read Genesis 1 in the English translation, it's abundantly clear this word day must have at least three distinct literal definitions, because three are used right there in the text. And that's something I again saw at age 17, I think everybody sees when they read the text. Creation day one, it's contrasting days and nights. That's day for the daylight hours. Creation day four, seasons, days, and years. That's day is 24 hours. Genesis 2:4 uses the word day to refer to the entirety of creation history. That's day is a long period of time. And a thing I noticed when I first picked it up, there's an evening and the morning for the first 6 days, but there is no evening and morning for the seventh day, which tells me right away the first 6 days have closure. The seventh day does not. We're still in the seventh day. And that's the day when God rests from his work of creation. And notice in the human era, we don't see any evidence for miraculous intervention in the world of biology. God is at rest, but we see it before. So to me, that's the plain reading of the text. And he says, well, you're a scientist. Of course you saw all that. Even when you're 17, you're able to see. Your testimony was you started studying science when you're 7. I said, well, I'm not the only one. I know of all kinds of people with no science background. They read the plain reading of the text and concluded it was billions of years. And that's where Richard Howe jumped in and said, see, it's a matter of interpretation. It's not a matter of biblical authority. So to me, this is a big step forward. I think if we again can have more sessions like that, it could make a big difference.
When do you have planned to have your next annual session?
Well, that's not planned yet. We need to find, I think it's important we find other sponsors who want to see this level of rhetoric. But one thing I've noticed, just talking with people in the audience, there's a groundswell within the Christian community. We have to do something with the rhetoric on this issue. I think we can take advantage of that and really start making things happen. Because I think if we change the rhetoric, that's going to go a long ways to resolving this division in the Christian community. But, you know, when I went on to speak at Regent University, we had not only students and faculty come to my talks, a lot of community people came. And it made me just realize, by the way, I got a really good reception to my 9 talks. They didn't get recorded, they're thinking of having me come back and do it again, getting them recorded and making it a course for the divinity students. Because what we found out is we got students in the divinity program, we got students in the arts and science program, and with a rather surprising lack of science literacy. The fact that I had to answer questions all the time on what is the scientific evidence that the world isn't flat? It's like, you know, if you graduated from high school, you shouldn't have to ask me those kinds of questions. You know, why are you being disturbed by all this stuff on the internet claiming that the world is flat? And I had several young earth creationists there who were insisting that there was this grand conspiracy in the scientific community. And they thought I was part of the conspiracy to fool people into thinking that the Earth and the universe were billions of years old. But it did really help, especially with the young Earth creationists in the audience, for me to explain the history of 20th century astronomy. And what I'm discovering is a lot of people don't even know this history. Even a lot of scientists don't know this history. How in the first half of the 20th century, there was a massive young universe, old universe debate. And there was astronomers in Britain who were working on stellar models who said, our models tell us the stars are at least trillions of years old. And therefore, what Edwin Hubble has come up with, where he says that the universe is 5 billion years old, by the way, and they're measuring the expansion of the universe, the first date they came up with was 2 billion years. And they said, no, that's in conflict with the what we know about the stars and the Earth, and so, but the number kept getting bigger and bigger as they were able to measure the expansion of the universe to greater and greater accuracy. But yet, for the first half of the 20th century, there was this big debate. Is the universe quadrillions of years old or only billions of years old? And a lot of the people pushing for the quadrillions were saying, we need at least that much time if we're going to save the Darwinian explanation of life. And we're going to have any hope of trying to claim that the origin of life is a naturalistic event. And so, but what happened towards the end of the 1940s, 1950s, especially the 1960s, is that we developed better models of the stars, which told us the stars were not trillions of years old, but only billions of years old. Bottom line was, the young universe astronomers won. It's only billions of years old, not quadrillions of years old. And my appeal to the young Earth creationists, notice that the difference between the young universe astronomers and the old universe astronomers was about six zeros. Likewise, the difference between you and those of us today is just six zeros. Taking care of six zeros isn't that hard. So, what can you do to resolve this? But I think what really appealed to them was the fact that these astronomers recognized that we're only dealing with billions. We do not have a naturalistic explanation for the origin and history of life. And that seems to be what's driving the young Earth model, is the idea that billions basically concedes the whole game to the non-theists in terms of the origin and history of life. It doesn't in any way. So, and then I finished up by giving talks at the Middle Tennessee State. And I thought it was kind of like a state university here. Discovered, hey, they're actually awarding PhDs in the hard sciences there. So it's basically an up-and-coming university. And again, they're really good at getting community people out as well as science and faculty. I don't want to spend my whole time talking about stuff. A lot of dramatic stuff happened. There was a major scientific discovery that occurred while I was gone. So I'm going to give you that, and then we're going to try to get some time. Yeah, we can get there. Some time into the book of Isaiah and the Trinity. And incidentally, while I was back east, the subject of the Trinity came up again and again. Unbelievers were bringing that subject up. And so I was making the point, science only makes sense if God is triune. And that really shocked the unbelievers there. You mean to say we can develop something akin to the doctrine of the Trinity without using the Bible at all, just looking at the scientific record? It says, yeah, you can actually do that. You can do that in multiple ways. So that's something we're actually going to be exploring as we go through the book of Isaiah. It's not just the book of Isaiah that teaches the doctrine of the Trinity. The book of nature teaches the doctrine of the Trinity. Now let me get this up here for you. This is it's actually two research papers that got published, but I'll focus on one in particular. If you want the details, I got a blog article coming out either this Monday or next Monday. But it has to do with what happens when you get outside the magnetosphere of planet Earth. And the bottom line is this. The result of this research study is that we've not really given enough credit to how important our magnetosphere is for human life here on planet Earth, and how a planet our size is unique, and that it's got such a perfectly designed magnetosphere to protect us. And basically what they're pointing out is that once you get outside the magnetosphere, you get exposed to these different kinds of radiation. Let's see, this will come up for you. Yeah, here we go.
What is the magnetosphere?
I'm going to tell you what the magnetosphere is in a minute.
Glad you
basically, asked. What it is that planet Earth is inside a gigantic magnetic bottle. Okay? All right. But once you get outside Earth's magnetosphere, you're going to be exposed to cosmic radiation. 89% of it are protons, 9% are helium nuclei, which is basically two protons and two neutrons, about 1% are electrons, and 1% are what they call heavy element nuclei. So we're talking about like a carbon nucleus, an oxygen nucleus, an iron nucleus, a uranium nucleus. That's what we mean by heavy element nuclei. And there's been a recognition for some time that our human bodies can tolerate being bombarded by protons and electrons. And the helium nuclei are not moving too fast. We can tolerate that to some degree. But the stuff that really does us damage are those heavy element nuclei. But because of our magnetosphere, our bodies don't get hit by this stuff very often. But they recognize that if you're out beyond the magnetosphere for a period of, say, 3 months or more, and keep in mind, the fastest way you can get to Mars is 6 months, And if you get there in 6 months, you're going to probably need 3.5 years to get back. So they just said, well, in 3 months, 30% of your body cells will be impacted by these heavy element nuclei. And unlike the protons and the neutrons, they do a lot of damage when they hit your cells. And so they ran an experiment. They didn't want to do it on humans. That would be unethical. So they ran it instead on mice. And they chose mice because this group of researchers were really interested. Okay, we noticed that mice have an intestinal tract that's a really good proxy for the human intestinal tract. I mean, mice are kind of like us. They can eat just the same kind of food we do, and they can digest it reasonably successfully. And the structure of their intestinal tract is very close to our intestinal tract. That's the amazing thing about mice and rats. We can use them for medical advance because of the way mice and rats emulate the design of our human organs in such a remarkable way. So yeah, here's a picture of a mouse. Okay. But what they did is they took a bunch of mice and basically exposed these mice to heavy element radiation. So they basically set up a laboratory where they simulated the heavy nuclei radiation they would be exposed to if they were outside the magnetosphere. And what they discovered is their intestinal tract suffered quite a bit of damage and suffered it quite quickly. And by the way, you want to know what the magnetosphere looks like? This is it. Maybe we could show, turn off one of the lights so you can actually see a little more clearly. Okay, and for those of you that are online with our live streaming or downloading, we're actually including the slides in the download now so you can see this. Now the red lines there represent the magnetosphere. And so for example, if you're in here or here, you're very well protected. If you're on planet Earth, you're very well protected. Once you get outside those red lines, or once you get deep into the magnetotail, now you begin to have exposure. And so for example, if you're sending astronauts to the moon, you can send them at a time when the moon is in this magnetotail, which means you're going to have very good protection most of the way to the moon and most of the way back. And if you pick the right time, you're even going to have at least some protection while you're on the moon. And when we sent the Apollo astronauts to the moon, that was actually taken into account. Actually sending them in a window where they would get maximum protection from Earth's magnetosphere. And moreover, we only kept them on the moon for a day or two so that they wouldn't have gotten that much exposure anyway. Now, once you get outside those red lines, now you get exposed to these heavy nuclei cosmic rays, and the research study indicated you get 6 consequences. And these are just the consequences for your intestinal tract. They said we leave it to future studies to determine what happens to your brain, what happens to your heart. We're only going to look at the intestinal tract. And what they discovered is the first symptom you're going to get is persistent oxidative stress in your intestinal tract. Now that's kind of a complex term. It basically means that you're going to have corrosion inside your intestinal tract. And it's going to cause pain, and it's going to cause you some discomfort, and you're not going to be able to digest your food that well. And moreover, you're going to begin to do damage to the intestinal tissues, which is actually going to allow pathogens to go from the intestine into your other bloodstream and organs. The other thing that they notice that happens quickly is you get DNA damage to the intestinal cells, and you get what's called cell senescence without apoptosis. Again, I'll try to explain that in lay language. That means it's true. There comes a time when your cells basically don't function that well. They basically stop doing what they're supposed to do, and it's like kind of what happens when you go to sleep. They just stop functioning. They're still alive, but they're not doing very much. And the intestinal tract is very efficiently designed to eliminate these cells. So that happens all the time, literally on an hourly basis. Your intestine is basically working to eliminate these cells that are no longer functioning like they should and getting them out. The problem is when you have this heavy nuclei radiation is that the intestinal tract is no longer able to efficiently remove these cells, so they pile up. And as they pile up, they begin to have consequences. And then they also notice, this is the biggest thing they notice, significantly decrease epithelial cell migration. And this is referring to the migration of cells inside the intestinal tract through the crypt cells. And this is crucial in order to maintain defense against pathological invasions. And so, yeah, we have this very efficient removal or movement of cells down the intestinal tract, and it really blocks the entry of pathogens into the intestinal tissues and where they can go from the intestinal tissues into the rest of your body. It also is very important to make sure you're efficiently digesting your food. So the point they point out in the paper is that if you've got this decrease of epithelial cell migration, it basically means you're going to have a significant loss of energy because you're not going to be able to efficiently process the food you eat to make the energy you need. So basically says if you do this with astronauts beyond the magnetosphere, you're going to have really lethargic astronauts who are going to be in a lot of intestinal discomfort. And so you're trying to get them to do stuff, they're not going to be able to do much. I think all of us have had episodes where we've had intense intestinal discomfort, and it really does affect your work performance. And then they basically said you're going to get this pathological invasion, which could be very damaging to other organs. And they said, we haven't studied that yet, those consequences, but one thing they did study, you get inflammatory intestinal bowel disease. That's a misspelling. That's not bowl. That's bowel. So I left the E out. I'm sorry. But there's a wide range of an intestinal inflammatory disorders. And again, they're incredibly disabling when you begin to experience them. And it says, you know, after about 2 or 3 months, you start getting intestinal malignant tumors. In other words, cancer. Intestinal cancer, bowel cancer. So,
can
and they ended their...
Can they shield us from these cosmic rays?
Pardon me?
Can they shield us from these cosmic rays?
Well, the paper actually addressed that, and I'll be addressing that too. Okay, so if you're going to the moon, this doesn't show up well, but you've got the Earth here and the moon here. This is actually taken by a satellite on its way to an asteroid, basically showing you the separation. And so if you go back to this one, if you actually pick the right time for the orbit of the moon about the Earth, you can get this shielding that you need for most of the way. And so, but yeah, the moon's farther away than most people think. It's 30 times the distance, 30 times the diameter of the Earth away. And so again, that brought up the point, okay, can we actually shield these astronauts? And here's the typical NASA plan, and it's the same as the Russian and Chinese plans on how to get from the Earth-Moon system out to the other planets with people. You basically have these spaceships, but what has been recognized, even just to get to Mars, you're going to need a spaceship with artificial gravity. Because you cannot have people living in zero gravity. Basically, you suffer bone loss. And even if you're exercising on a treadmill 4 hours a day, you still lose 1% of your bone mass per month, and it's permanent. Which basically means anything longer than a month or two, and you're not going to be able to, you're going to have serious consequences when you come back to Earth. A good example of that is Yuri Gagarin, the Russian cosmonaut. He spent 6 months in orbit around the Earth under zero gravity, and they didn't have an exercise machine that gave him artificial gravity, and he wound up dying because his bones could no longer support his body mass when he got back to Earth. He didn't live very long. So that is something that is now recognized. You have to have artificial gravity. So in this case, you've got this spinning system where you've got people here, and they're basically being pushed at the back with 1G gravity. It's not as easy as it sounds, because to really make this effective, you want the living space to be large. Because if it's small, you actually get deviations on gravity just by moving a few feet from the optimal point in the spaceship. But the bigger you make the spaceship, the bigger you can make the sweet spot where you got 1G gravity. And the other thing is, you really want it to be a whole lot longer than what you see here, because you don't want the gravity to be different at your head than it is at your feet. And so this diagram here really isn't adequate. Right away, I think you can see your tax dollars beginning to expand to make this possible. Because we now recognize that that's not adequate. You've got to make the beam a lot longer and the living space a lot bigger. But the real problem is, there's no technological way of making a magnetic bottle around this spaceship. I mean, for example, you've got to have this artificial gravity. You're going to need a magnetic bottle to go around the whole thing. And we can't even make a magnetic bottle to get controlled fusion. I mean, I remember when I was an undergraduate student in the 1960s, they were saying, by the year 2000, we'll have controlled fusion. And the pathway to controlled fusion is to build a magnetic bottle where we trap hydrogen atoms in such concentration that they fuse into helium and generate energy. And the promise is, if we could ever do that, we could have all the energy we need without greenhouse gases, and it would supply us with everything. But the problem is, to this day, they've not been able to make a stable magnetic bottle. We can't even make a bottle that's stable for 1 second. Even a microsecond is a challenge. And so the idea of making a magnetic shield around a spaceship is not only not technologically feasible now, they don't even have a conceivable technological pathway to make it happen. And it's also led to a recognition, if we can have the lights on again, that we live on an extraordinary planet. Jupiter, for example, has a strong magnetic field. The amazing thing about planet Earth, we have a strong magnetic field around a very tiny planet. So we've got this small rocky planet with a stable, strong magnetic field where this magnetosphere protects life on planet Earth for billions of years. That's why we humans can be here in this room today. If it wasn't for this stable, strong magnetosphere being in place for 4 billion years, human life would not be possible here on planet Earth. And the article I'm writing on this, because this isn't in the peer-reviewed papers, but the article I'm writing on this is making the point. We have this very powerful magnetic field because we're living on a planet that's got 630 times as much thorium as what we would anticipate other rocky planets in the universe to have, and 340 times as much uranium. And it's a radioactive decay of uranium and thorium. And those are both long-lived radioactive isotopes. They can literally radioactively decay for billions of years and provide the energy that's necessary to liquefy the outer inner core of the Earth. And the other amazing thing about the core of our Earth, it's almost entirely ferrous metals, iron, nickel, and cobalt. Ferrous metals are metals that are easy to magnetize, and it's liquid, so the movement of these ferrous it's liquid because of the heat release from the uranium and thorium, and all that iron and cobalt and nickel establishes this powerful magnetic field. It also gives us plate tectonics, which we need for advanced life. But the bottom line is, this gives us a lot more reasons to thank God for the magnetosphere. So come next month when you celebrate Thanksgiving, I hope you spend a few minutes thanking God for our amazing magnetosphere that makes possible our existence here on Earth and our ability to orbit about the sun and not get killed by these deadly cosmic rays. And hopefully it'll be good news for the U.S. taxpayer, in the sense that we're going to have our government realizing we need to be sending machines to Mars, not people to Mars. I mean, I'm hoping this paper really wakes up the aerospace community. It's time we forget about sending people to Mars or Venus or Jupiter or whatever. We need to send machines. So hopefully all of you that work at JPL will be excited about this, because that's what distinguishes JPL from NASA Houston. JPL is all about sending machines. And the taxpayers here should be excited too. It's way cheaper to send a machine than it is to send a human being. And now we have the technology where I would argue machines can discover more information than humans can. They're actually better at giving us knowledge of what's going on Mars and Jupiter and the other places. But of course, I think what's driving all this, people wanting to actually set up a colony in Mars, make it a second habitable planet. But hey, if you can't even get there without killing everybody, then... you know, I think it's even going to be a challenge to put a colony in the moon, because, as I mentioned, sometimes the moon is protected by our magnetosphere, but most of the time it's not. And so to have a permanent colony in the moon, again, means that you're going to get significant exposure. And so, yeah, living on the moon for 6 months is not an option. Your digestive tract will be destroyed. Wow. Yeah.
Hey. Wouldn't a 3-4-inch wet box that you lived in with no windows protect you also?
Yeah. The space.
That's what I first proposed. It's no fun to sit in a wet box for 4 years.
That was a serious proposal.
Go ahead.
Okay, that was a serious proposal. It's no longer considered a serious proposal for several reasons. Number one, you'd need a whole lot of lead. Because we're talking blocking out fast-moving, heavy nuclei cosmic rays. And just a thin layer of lead will not do.
Three, 4 inches
would do that? About a foot thickness of lead would do it. Okay, so one of the problems with lead is it's soft. You've got to find some way to sustain the lead so that it doesn't kind of flow. You've got to stop the lead from flowing. And that, and more, it's heavy.
Very
so,
heavy.
And it's so heavy that you're talking, we're going to shield astronauts with, say, 6 to 12 inches of lead. That kind of forces them to have a small living space. And too small.
No windows,
right? The other problem is, no matter how pure your lead is, there will be uranium and thorium in it. After all, uranium and thorium come from the decay. Our lead comes from the decay of uranium and thorium. So it's really hard to get pure lead. You're all going to, and of course, if you've got a foot thickness of lead all the way around you, you will be exposed to a lot of radioactive decay from uranium and thorium. Anyway, the scientific community basically gave up on the idea a couple of decades ago, just saying this is not practical. We couldn't make a living space big enough and shield them, and hey, they'd still be exposed to radiation. And so that's why they're thinking the only option is an artificial magnetosphere, but at this point they're saying we don't even have a conception of how one could be constructed. The very fact that we can't make a tiny magnetic bottle to house protons tells us it's not going to work. Yes?
I understand that there are lava tubes, subterranean lava tubes on the moon. Would they possibly be able to shield in any way?
Yes, I mean, that's one way you can do it. Go way underground. Things, the same thing they proposed on Mars. You don't want to live on the surface of Mars, you want to live underground, where you're going to be protected from those deadly dust storms and be protected from the radiation.
No windows.
But the whole point is, yeah, no windows. They're not going above ground.
Is there no magnetosphere on Mars?
There's no magnetosphere on Mars.
I'm talking about Mars.
We only got two planets that have a magnetosphere, and that's Jupiter and Earth.
Is Jupiter, is it stable like? I don't think it's stable.
And it's not stable Earth like ours.
It's stable, it's a big thing. It's not as big, but it's stable.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with Jupiter, you got these storms that come and go, so yeah. Earth is unique, and that's something that I'm hoping this paper will alert everybody to realize. We live on an extraordinary planet that's got this amazing magnetosphere that probably exists nowhere else in the universe. And because of that, we're able to exist here on planet Earth. And maybe it'll tell us we better take better care of our planet. You know, Stephen Hawking, when he was alive, was saying, we're ruining the planet. We need to abandon ship and go to another planet. Well, this study, it means your gastrointestinal tract will not tolerate you going from this planet to another planet. And won't even tolerate you getting to Venus or Mars. And again, all you JPL folks here in the class, let's go with the machines. That's really the way to go. It saves money, and you're going to learn a whole lot more, and nobody dies. At least I hope nobody dies. Okay. But there's no more questions. How much time do I have left before we get into yes?
I would like to return to the subject of death for just a
sure.
It seems to me that so as recently as 100 years ago, I think virtually all denominations believed that death came with the fall of man. That is, that really nobody thought about whether plants and animals died, and then Adam sinned. So it seems to me we have not developed that theology very well, differentiating between natural death and spiritual death. I certainly don't hear sermons about it. So I'd like to hear what is your position? Could you clarify your position on that, and what should we be teaching about natural versus spiritual death?
Well, I had to engage a lot of young earth creationists, both in Virginia and North Carolina, and even some when I was in Tennessee. And a lot of them basically don't check their Bible to see what it actually says, because they were telling me, well, the Bible tells us death came through Adam, and all have died because of Adam's sin. I says, well, let's actually open up the Bible and see what it really does say. Romans 5:12, death through sin as a result of Adam's offense was visited upon all people. Doesn't say all life, it says all people. It also says it happens to those who sin. Dogs and cats don't sin. Apricots don't sin. The only creature, only species of life that sins are humans. So notice you got Paul making two very careful qualifications. We're talking about just that species that experiences sin, and we're talking death to all people. We're not talking death to all life. And moreover, you got passages in the Bible that talk about God blessing his creation with carnivores. So you'll see this in Psalm 104, you see it in Job 38, how God shows his love by providing prey for the raven and prey for the lion. And so I think you can use those texts to say, from a biblical perspective, predatory activity is not a bad thing, it's a good thing. And as I got to share with several young earth creationists in these talks I was giving, notice this young earth, old earth divide in the church is an urban phenomenon. Once you get out into a rural area, people recognize, gee, we really need the predators. Bad things happen when you don't have predators in the environment. And what happens is the death rate for the herbivore skyrockets. And you know, the motivation of most young earth creationists is a loving God is going to minimize the suffering that results as a result of physical death. And saying, well, carnivores actually help minimize the death rate and minimize the suffering in death. Because if you don't have herbivores or carnivores, the herbivores, when they die, suffer to a far greater degree than if you've got carnivores. And part of it, too, is we look at carnivorous activity from our human perspective. We humans can kill anything we want. And so when hunting season opens up, what do the hunters do? They look for the very best animals to kill. So they'll kill the prize males or the prize females. What happens when the other carnivores hunt is they don't have the ability. They've been designed by God in such a way that they don't have the ability to hunt the most healthy and adult animals. So what do? They prey upon the ones that are close to death, those that have serious injuries and disease. And by feeding on the diseased animals, they protect the other surviving herbivores from getting those diseases and suffering likewise. So actually you see the death rate drop when you've got carnivores. But if you live in a city, you may not realize that. And I also would argue, I encountered an incredible degree of science illiteracy during all these talks I was giving. And my wife says, because I was educated in Canada, at a time when the Sputnik thing was all about, there was this big panic, you know, the Russians are getting ahead of us in science. So I got saturated in science education, most of my generation did. But I'm now realizing my son's generation, it's not that way. And for example, when I took public high school, it's like we were encouraged to take biology, chemistry, physics, and advanced math. What I hear from my sons is, you can graduate from high school with a biology class. That's it. You can avoid taking the chemistry, the math, and the physics. And that's kind of what people tell you. Well, you know, it'll be easy to get an A in biology. It's going to be a little more challenging to do that in calculus or physics. And so there's a selection effect going on. And I think we probably need another one of those scares. Hey, we're falling behind in science. We need to actually upgrade the science education. But I would think, too, even biology should be enough to tell you that we don't live on a flat Earth. or we don't live on an earth that's only thousands of years old. I mean, read the Bible. I mean, it seems obvious to me David realized that the earth is ancient because he talked about the ancient hills. He talked about the ancient river Kishon. So, in the back, and how much time do I have before I need to close?
12:15,
okay.
Forgive my ignorance, but younger people, they don't think that there was the eating of plants and animals or dying, I mean, the eating of plants by animals before the fall?
You get a division in the young earth community. I found many of them who will say, the Bible never says the plants are living creatures. And so they say, yeah, plants were dying, but not animals. And then some will say, we're talking about the higher animals. We're saying, it's okay for mosquitoes to die and flies to die, but not bunny rabbits. So you get a variation. Well, they're basically saying, yeah, that Adam was created on the end of the sixth day, and so plants were on the third day, and the animals got by without killing those plants.
Even for one day.
Yeah, I mean, just fasting for a day or two.
And you don't eat the whole plant; you leave it in the ground so it can sprout.
Yeah, but then there's young earth creationists that said we can't even tolerate plant parts dying. So again, you get a variation, but to be fair, most old earth creations draw the line at animals. They're saying, we don't really think plants are ever addressed as being alive. They'll make references to the fact that Jesus says the lily withers. He didn't say it died, he only said it withers. So they make the distinction. However, in my book, A Matter of Days, I actually point out places where it actually states that plants are living. They're alive, and uses the same word for life and death for the plants that he uses for human beings. There's not a different Hebrew word. But again, a lot of young earth creationists will draw that line. I debated one young earth creationist philosopher who said, I draw the line at the nephesh animals. And so if it's a bird or a mammal that has emotions, then they didn't die. But the creatures that have no emotions, then I don't really think that's an issue. But again, it's kind of like the abortion issue. I mean, where do you draw the line? Okay, if you're going to say it's 3 months inside the womb, what happens when you get the technology to save a fetus that's 2 months in the womb? So the Bible says at the point of conception. So if you've got a variable line, then it's difficult to develop a consistent doctrine. But and again, their whole idea is that an all-powerful, all-loving God is not going to kill a cute little bunny rabbit. So, but what happens to rabbits when they don't have carnivores? And there was a famous incident in Australia about 60, 70 years ago where they brought rabbits into Australia. The rabbit population just multiplied. And what happened is huge disease issues with the rabbits, terrible suffering and death on the part of the rabbits because there were no carnivores to cull the wheat. Well, the problem was the weak and diseased rabbits were able to live as well as the healthy, fit rabbits. There was no carnivores there to remove those that were sick and weak and dying. So, okay, we got a few minutes. Yeah, I thought I had a few minutes left.
How is the scientific community accepting this new information about the magnetosphere and that it's not too likely for people to live on Mars? I mean, isn't it kind of upsetting them?
Well, this just got published. So it's too soon yet to get a strong reaction. That's one reason why I'm telling you here, because I know there's several of you that work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I think this should be a real good buzz at JPL and might even increase the funding for JPL if this actually gets recognized throughout NASA that, hey, we really need to be putting our money into JPL and cutting the budget for NASA Houston. So I'll be interested to see how this plays out. But I think anyone who reads the paper realizes it's game over for human interplanetary space travel. This is just not going to work. So I mean, the idea that okay, maybe you can go to Mars and die on Mars. The problem is you're going to die before you get to Mars.
So shows the uniqueness of God's making the Earth so special.
Yeah, we live on a special, and that's what I really hope people gain from this, is a recognition just how amazingly designed our planet is to make our existence possible. And like, we've got a magnetosphere like no other. And the fact that it's on a tiny planet, that's what makes it miraculous. Because it's one thing to get this on a big planet like Jupiter, but as you know, Dave pointed out, it wouldn't be stable. We got a strong, stable, enduring magnetosphere. It's nothing short of a miracle. And if we recognize that, people are going to say, there's got to be a God to explain this.
So the problem with you is most people are getting their science from Hollywood. That's what I get. Yeah. So you have movies, The Martian, you have Mars on TV. Unfortunately, a large mass part of our population are getting their science from Hollywood, which is just total fiction, unfortunately.
Well, I had a hard time watching that movie, The Martian, with my sons, because they begin by showing Matt Damon walking about 12 or 15 miles on the Martian surface, and he's walking like he's here on Earth. So wait a minute, there's only 40% gravity on Mars. You're not going to be able to walk like that. You're going to challenge just walking, you know, a few yards, let alone walking at that pace. And of course, there's no way you're growing potatoes on Martian soil. Martian soil's got 60 times the sulfur that Earth soil has. So, yeah, let alone the breathing problems there that you'd have. Okay, I only got 2 minutes left, so let me set things up for next week, okay? Here we go. Okay, these are the passages that we've developed so far on the book of Isaiah. Actually, this is not the list. This is a list I developed. I'm going to go down to the list you're developing. Here we go. Remember, we went for the first 22 chapters of Isaiah, picking up all the passages that pertain to the Trinity. Now, I'm guessing that while I was gone, you actually completed the list up through chapter 44. Is that correct?
No.
Not really? Okay. But you've all done that for homework, right?
No.
Okay. Guess what? Between now and next week, please read Isaiah 23 to 44 and pick up all the passages that pertain to the Trinity. Because, I mean, we actually had about 15 minutes in the class here where a bunch of you collected that. So a lot of that work has already been done. But if you didn't finish, you know, come next week. Because what I want to do next week is this. We start off right away by getting all those passages that you've collected from Isaiah 23 to Isaiah 44. And then we're going to look at the last third. Because what's interesting about the book of Isaiah, as I said before, the book of Isaiah, I'm supposed to be in front of this camera, I'm sorry for those of you that are live streaming. The book of Isaiah has more in the doctrine of the Trinity than any other book of the Bible, and you've got almost equal amounts in the first third, the second third, and the last third, although the second third is the most extensive. So we'll come prepared next week. We'll get that list, and we'll get this all prepared. And then what we're going to go through is these passages one at a time and basically ask the question, is this text really addressing the doctrine of the Trinity? Because I know you've got a bigger list than what we should end up with, but it's always good to start with a bigger list than a smaller list. So yeah, this is what I want to fill out next time, okay? We've got it all ready there to fill out. And we'll collect all these passages. And then we're going to actually answer the questions on your question sheet about what the book of Isaiah says about the Trinity. And hey, if you've got friends that are Jews or Muslims, this is a great study to bring them to. Because in both of those issues, they deny the doctrine of the Trinity, but they believe the book of Isaiah is inspired scripture. And so that's what's interesting. Muslims, Jews, and Christians all believe the book of Isaiah is inspired by the Holy Spirit of God, and it's the book of Isaiah that tells us the doctrine of the Trinity. But the vast majority of Jews and Muslims that I engage deny that Isaiah says anything about the Trinity. But it's just that they haven't read it. They need to look at it and see what it says. And I'll close with this. The astrophysicist who heads up Reasons to Believe for us in Africa at the University of Witwatersrand, Dr. David Block, he was raised as an Orthodox Jew. And he became a Christian to reading all the Old Testament texts as rabbis told him not to read. And what he told me is the forbidden texts, many of them were in the book of Isaiah. And when he read them, he realized, wow, this book of Isaiah talks about redemption, it talks about the Trinity, and he said that's the problem to faith in Christ. So, one of the big factors. And a number of his family members have become that way too. All right, let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, I want to thank you, first of all, Lord, for this amazing discovery that just got published about our magnetosphere and this experiment done on mice that basically tells us how grateful we should be that we have the protection of that magnetosphere. And Father, I pray that that would actually restructure the way we do interplanetary research. Lord, that we would take into account the need to protect our humans. And Father, I pray that you would actually use this to boost the space exploration program, because Father, we know the more we learn about our planetary system, the more evidence we get of just how amazingly designed our planetary system is and our planet Earth is to make possible our existence during this narrow window of time. So Father, I pray that this would be a pathway for many scientists and engineers to come to faith in Jesus Christ, but not just scientists and engineers, Lord, that everybody would realize what an amazingly designed planet we live on, a planet that you graciously structured and fabricated for our very existence. And Father, may we realize you did that because you got a purpose for each one of us. Help us to find that purpose and to fill that purpose, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.